You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
But this particular talk, I'm hoping that you'll hear for this, is about stopping funding the climate crisis. And I'm going to pass over to you and ask you to introduce yourselves, but I am listening with bearded ears because I would like to know more too. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for all being here. It's wonderful to see you today. This is around stopping funding the climate crisis and Christians holding banks accountable for their actions and what they finance. And before we get started, we have a treat for you. Well, thank you so much to the Climate Choir for starting our session off so beautifully. They were singing The Path to Justice, and the words of which are a poem written by Faith Sebwa. And she's a teenage Kenyan climate campaigner and deaf poet. And Faith was the youngest member of the World Council of Churches delegation to the COP climate talks in Dubai. And she wrote these moving words that the choir just sang when she was just 13 years old. It featured in a World Council of Churches report, which received global coverage. It was covered by newspapers around the world, including the UK, where a British musician, Helen Williams, contacted the World Council of Churches team to say that she'd read this poem, and as she was reading it, a tune came to her heart, and could she please set it to music? And those are the words and the tune that you've just heard. And the words are particularly resonant for the discussion we're about to have, because they're a rallying cry to Christians to take strong climate action, even legal action, taking our demands to the courts. One of the lines reads, "Financial powers vast and strong, we call them out when they go wrong. And if that fails, we know the call to find the courts and give our all." And this session, we're going to hear shortly about how the Methodist Church, both here and in Colombia, is making legal interventions in light of HSBC's ongoing financing of environmental harm. In particular, their environmental harm in Colombia, because for many years they've provided finance to Glencore, the multinational mining company that owns the Cerrejón mine. And that's the largest open pit coal mine in Latin America. And it has been responsible for egregious environmental harms over many years and decades. And after years of unsuccessful engagement with HSBC, which has failed to amend its ways, the Methodist Church is now turning to legal action and legal routes to challenge their behaviour. And so we're going to learn more about their legal actions and think about how we as churches can follow suit and use legal mechanisms to hold big polluters to account. So my next step is to introduce the panellists, which I'm very delighted to do. I'm very pleased to be sitting alongside some colleagues from Epworth and the Methodist Church and the Just Money Movement. So first of all, we have Andrew Harper, who is the Deputy CEO of Epworth, an investment management firm that is owned by the Methodist Central Finance Board. And next to him is Hamish Lees, who's the Director of Environmental Engagement at the Methodist Church. And Rosie Venner, who is the Director of Movement Building at the Christian charity Just Money Movement. And we have one seat empty because we were also hoping to have our colleague from the World Council of Churches, Frederique Seidel. But unfortunately, she can't come because of climate change. She was coming to join us from Geneva, but she has been flooded and she can't leave. So she's not with us today. So we're going to sort of say her words for her. But a round of applause for our panel, please. So I'm going to put a new hat on. I am now Frederique from the World Council of Churches, and I will share a few words from her message for us this afternoon. I was going to ask Frederic, why is the World Council of Churches supporting legal action related to banks' environmental harms? Because it's a huge umbrella body. What role do they see they're playing? And her response was that the World Council of Churches represents over 500 million Christians in over 120 countries. And 10 years ago, they developed a program called Churches Commitments to Children, looking at how we as an aging global church can be looking at the inheritance we leave to the next generation. And they worked in collaboration with UNICEF to do research across the world, consulting children and young people in churches on how they can best be supported, not just on climate issues, but across the board. And a strong theme that emerged from that consultation process was that children globally felt so scared by the climate emergency, not just by the climate emergency that they were learning about in their schools and witnessing in their day-to-day lives, but that alongside the inaction they were seeing from adults, from their churches and from their governments. And they felt that they were just watching decision makers doing the opposite to what is needed to protect the environment at the same time as facing this environmental crisis. So the World Council of Churches sort of took this away and developed a Cooler Earth, Higher Benefits campaign. And that encourages churches globally to ensure that their money is not invested in sectors that threaten children's futures. They were particularly convicted by the words of a teenager in the US who was involved in their, through their church, taking legal action for climate justice, who were saying, "Our efforts as children feel in vain if at the same time you adults continue putting money into banks that finance fossil fuel expansion." So this new World Council of Churches program encourages churches around the world to speak to their banks about not only decarbonising but not funding any sectors of harm, but then moving their money if those banks don't change their ways, and moving intentionally into climate solutions. Because their research has shown that the lever of financial choices is one of the most impactful for climate solutions, yet currently one of the least utilised. So by holding banks accountable, we as churches can have a huge impact in accelerating climate solutions and addressing these environmental harms. So I will take my hat off again. That was Frederic's 5 minutes worth of context, really, as to why the World Council of Churches are supporting churches around the world to take these legal steps and empower themselves and educate themselves about the legal routes available. And one of those churches who is pioneering this approach is the Methodist Church. And the Methodist Church of Great Britain, Ireland and Colombia are coming together to take this action against HSBC. So I'd love to hand over to Andrew now. So can you explain to us, Andrew, what action is the Methodist Church taking and why?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Nice to see you, everybody. It's my first time at this festival, and it's really nice to be here. So I think we've been offered a great bargain, a bargain that tells us that economic progress is the highest virtue we can seek, a bargain that says creation is a resource to be extracted, that humanity is a resource to be sorted, numbered, and optimized, and that our worth and the worth of the creation around us is only in its ability to generate economic value. And if you aren't a productive commodity, you can be killed, you can be erased, you can be destroyed. And that's the reality. We see this expression through events across history and even happening today. Genocide, war, apartheid, oppression, climate-fueled natural disasters, famine. We know the list. It goes on and on and on. And all of this happens against a backdrop of an increasingly concentrated level of power, where fewer and fewer companies, and in this modern technological world, fewer and fewer individuals, actually, are changing our present and our future. And this is all happening without any democratic process. Nobody consented to this at all. There was no vote. There was no referendum. No one consulted local communities, much less the general public at large. And in a great act of deflection and gaslighting, the consumer, the public, all of you are being blamed for the negative effects. Now, the organization I work for, Epworth Investment Management, was born out of the anti-apartheid movement. It was born out of the movement that started the Central Finance Board of the Methodist Church. We rejected the bargain being offered to us then, and we still reject it today. Our work against HSBC, I think, is the best expression of this rejection. As you heard, despite promising to end the financing of thermal coal extraction and other fossil fuels, HSBC has repeatedly, time after time, ignored its own policies, which no one asked them to write. They wrote them themselves. They adopted them themselves. They've chosen to ignore them. You've heard about the Cerrejón mine. The Cerrejón mine came about in the mid-1970s, and it really is the prime example of how not to run a mine if you care about people and planet. It has been a mass extraction exercise in every sense of the word, and it's been polluting millions and millions of people's water supply, air supply, and lived environment. It's cost thousands of lives, directly and indirectly. There are increased rates of birth deformity. There are increased rates of learning difficulties. There's a shorter lifespan in the neighboring communities and those downstream in the water supply because those people have been deemed to have no economic value. What does this tell us about a bank that's willing to finance that sort of project? Well, just like the grand bargain that's being thrust upon us, it shows us a bank who values profit over life. The indigenous people in Cerrejón have no economic value to the bank, and therefore they are expendable. Even worse, they actually are a hindrance. They're a risk to revenue. They protest. How dare they? We should set them aside. Their lives not only hold no value to the bank, they actually are in the way. Pushed aside, the local communities in Cerrejón have lost, or have at least had their God-given agency reduced to being a nuisance or a threat. Now, as faith investors, as customers of HSBC, as investors in HSBC, we see it as our responsibility to help center those voices, to bring them into the conversation, to make the boardrooms wholly uncomfortable with what's going on across the globe. Often there's a huge disconnect between what's happening in a London boardroom and what's happening on the ground in many of these projects. And those feelings, those damages, those lives lost are hidden in dense spreadsheets that no one really understands. They're reduced to numbers, and they're set against tolerances that are acceptable. I sat with a group of miners from a community in Gondo, Brazil, and they sat at the base of a tailings dam that was operated by Anglo American. And they were moved by the mining company because the level of the tailings dam had become too dangerous and it was at risk of collapse. Now, what the mining company didn't say was that, contrary to Brazilian law, they raised the tailings dam, and when challenged in the courts, they had new judges elected and they paid for the campaigns of these new judges to get the law changed. But they moved this community, who were just numbers, 30 families, a blip on a balance sheet. They moved these families and built them new homes, but they didn't give them the deeds to their homes. Well, these people were artisanal cheese producers. I didn't know artisanal cheese was produced in Brazil, but that's what they did. And they would sell that cheese into the local communities, into hospitals, into schools, things like that. Well, Brazilian law, which they have to adhere to, even if the mining company doesn't, says that without the deeds to your homes, you can't get a business license or an agricultural license. So they couldn't operate their livelihoods. They were slaves to the mining company. Now, when we challenged Anglo-American on this, they said, well, we've sent them the deeds. Look, here's the proof. And the deeds were all in English. These people couldn't even read and write in their local language, much less English. In London, they had no connection to the lived experience of the local community. And I think that's exactly what's happening in places like HSBC and other major banks. I don't want to over-anthropomorphize a company. Companies, I don't think, can be evil. But they can be made up of people who are naive, who are ignorant willingly or unwillingly. And that creates very evil traits and behaviors of a company. So what we try to do, and what I encourage all of you to do, appeal to their humanity. People on boards, people in positions of power in these places, they have families. They're normal people. They don't all have horns and tails, I can assure you. I've met some of them. I've had lunch with some of them. They're normal people. And often they're so detached, living in the upper echelons and operating in those upper echelons, they're so detached from the lived experience of local communities that they actually become appalled by the actions. So appeal to their humanity. I'm afraid to say that didn't work with HSBC. For decades, we have tried to engage with HSBC to very little effect. And we grew tired of it. We appeared in 180 publications in the UK and across the globe over the last 18 months, calling out HSBC's climate actions or inaction. And they didn't listen. I was told by the Associated Press that there was a picture of my face in the press office of HSBC that was being used as a dartboard. So that was quite humorous. But they still don't listen. There's still a disconnect. So we had to do something greater. Our next recourse, something that has never been done by a regulated investment management company in this country, we sought legal action against HSBC. And together with the local communities, because remember, this is about centering, not speaking on behalf of the local communities, together with the Methodist Church in Colombia and other evangelical groups in Colombia and Catholic groups in Colombia, we brought these complaints together and we filed an OECD complaint. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's going to force HSBC into a series of disclosures. It's going to make public what they've tried to keep quiet for decades. And even further, if the complaint is upheld, it's going to open up the formal legal routes for the local people in Colombia to seek legal action in this country, where they can be held to a standard of law. It's going to open up those routes for them to seek compensation from people like HSBC. So we hope the complaint is successful. We've never done it before, so this is kind of new to us. But I can assure you it will be the first of many complaints we will file as these banks continue to not listen. What can you do? I'll just say quickly. It's not easy to file an OECD complaint. We had to hire barristers and lawyers, and there's people doing research and all sorts of things to get all the facts correct, because you want to make your best effort in a complaint. I see, though, churches and communities and individuals accepting this great bargain that's been offered to us. passively almost, unknowingly. And frameworks developing at denominational levels, at government levels, at community levels, that are trying to teach people how to operate within that great bargain, within this new framework we're supposed to accept. But the bargain is still on the table. We don't have to accept this urgency of inevitability that the way things are heading are the way things that have to be. So I would call each of you to reject the bargain, to call and be a nuisance to your bank, to be a risk to them financially. Move with your feet, move your money into places that don't benefit them. Many of you will be pension holders. You may not be traditional investors in the sense of those people that we manage, but many of you will be pension holders. And pensions contribute some of the largest amounts of money in this country towards things like fossil fuel financing. That's a place where you can have a voice. And there's requirements now increasingly by the regulators for pension providers to listen to your voice and then be a nuisance to your MPs, because they're certainly a nuisance to us. I think that about covers what we can do and what the church is thinking. I think that we're tired, just like all of you. I didn't think we'd still be talking about these type of issues for so long. And I don't think they will get it until the Hermes ties become wet on Canary Wharf from floodwaters. You know, until it's their lived reality, they're not going to get it. So we have to bring that reality to them. And that's about sharing the stories and centering those voices of the local communities.
Thank you, Andrew. I mean, that's such a powerful call to all of us, isn't it? To look out for our sisters and brothers and represent them, bring their humanity to the financial institutions we all have a stake in, whether that be through our current accounts or our investments or our pensions. We all have a stake, and we are all complicit if we're not actively moving our money out of this sort of activity. Thank you so much for that description of how to some of these big corporations' lives are just lines on a spreadsheet. And there is work of all of us as Christians who see inherent in value and dignity in all life to be challenging that and assuring that lives don't, if they don't have financial value, they still have infinite human value. Thank you so much. In terms of what we can do, before I hand over to Hamish, at the beginning I should have started circulating these clipboards, because one very practical thing we can each do in this tent today is add our names to an open letter to HSBC in solidarity and with the Methodist Church, saying that we share these values and that we call on HSBC to be more transparent and to change their practices. So please do pass around. There's a couple of sheets of sign-up paper, and then at the back, if you want to read a little bit more exactly what you're signing up to, the back page should give you a bit more detail. Brilliant. So I'd love to hand over now to Hamish, who's going to talk a little bit more about, I suppose, why as Christians we should be taking this sort of action to major polluters and some of the practical steps we can all take. So, Hamish, over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Andrew, as well, for everything you've said. It's really helpful as we take forward this conversation. I've been given the slightly unenviable task of explaining why Christians care about the climate crisis in 5 minutes. So I think this is something that we could talk about for hours. I suspect it's something that many of us have talked about for hours. I will do my best to condense everything down to around about 5 minutes, but it's fair to say I probably won't be able to cover everything within that time, but hopefully it will give us a taste of what's of why this is a really live issue for us as Christians, and particularly in my role within the Methodist Church. I think it's also helpful to build on a lot of this was really implicit in what Andrew was saying and then what was drawn out by Claire as well, but it's helpful to draw out some of these things explicitly, I think, to help us in this conversation. As Claire mentioned, and as I've already mentioned, I am coming to this speaking as an employee of the Methodist Church in Great Britain. So I will come to this probably with a slightly Methodist language and that Methodist background. But we are fortunate that though there are some areas where our theology as different Christian denominations varies, actually in this area we are all very much on the same page. So there is a lot of shared theology and theological understanding as we engage with these issues. So in 2021, the Methodist Conference, which is the highest decision-making body within the Methodist Church, officially affirmed that the climate crisis is a crisis for God's creation and a fundamental injustice. And I think it's helpful for us to just spend a little bit of time in unpacking both halves of that, really. It is a crisis for God's creation, and it's a fundamental injustice. So we hear all throughout the Bible, very much in the accounts in Genesis, the accounts of creation in Genesis, but all the way through the Bible, we hear about God's love for creation. And one of the Bible passages, probably the most well-known Bible passage, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And God didn't give his only son for humans. I mean, we're part of that. We're part of the world. God, of course, does love humans, but God's love is not limited only to humans. So God demonstrates love for all of creation. And when we think about those Genesis accounts of creation, we tend to focus a little bit on Genesis 1, and we can get ourselves quite bogged down in conversations of dominion, stewardship. I haven't got long enough to dive into those in any great depth. I do think when we do see models of dominion in the Bible, they're not actually ones of exploitation, of control. They're ones of love, of a shepherd tending to sheep. So even if we do think in terms of dominion, actually the model that we have is one of love and care rather than exploitation. And I think sometimes it's helpful for us to look as well to Genesis 2, where we hear more about the call to care for creation, to tend to creation. And that gives us a really different message. And I think what we've heard in what Andrew has said and what we see in the world today is not humanity caring and tending for creation. It reaches that exploitation, that worst form of dominion, rather than that real biblical sense of love and shepherding of a flock. So we are called to echo and demonstrate God's love for creation. But going back to that phrase from the Methodist Church's position on this, it's a crisis for God's creation, and it's a fundamental injustice. As Christians, we are called to love justice, to be justice seekers, to be people of justice. And the accounts that Andrew shared with us really, they go a long way to demonstrating how much of what we're challenging in this is not living up to that call to be justice seekers. It's by now well established that climate change disproportionately affects those who've done least to cause it, and those who have the least material resources to deal with the impacts of climate change. And that's true globally. I certainly don't want to downplay or minimise the impacts within the UK, and certainly we've seen those impacts in the last weeks and months. And as we see globally within the UK, those who are most impacted are those who are living in deprived communities, those who don't have access to the resources and common goods that many others do. But equally, when we experience drought in this country, and that has an impact of increasing food prices and many of those things, the very same event in other parts of the world can have a huge, huge impact. And that's where we see famine and all of these issues that come from that, which, although it may be broadly the same issue that we're experiencing, they're experienced in very different ways. So there is an injustice to the impacts of climate change. But as we think about the Serachon mine and others, we also need to think about the direct impacts of those activities. As Andrew has said, the displacement of individuals, the health impacts, the environmental impacts, which are being imposed on those communities for the ostensible benefit of those of us in other parts of the world. And so as we're called, again, to be people of justice, we need to engage with these injustices that we see, and climate change is a huge, huge justice issue. So I think to kind of answer that question of why do Christians care, why do we care about the climate crisis, I think precisely because it is inextricably and inescapably an issue of mission and justice.
Thank you very much for that. And I like the way that you sort of show how diametrically opposed that exploitation of God's creation is to his love for his creation, and how as Christians it's very firmly in our wheelhouse to want to act and to take steps to challenge that. I think that it's an offence to God's love, isn't it, to see his people and his world be exploited in that way. So thank you. We've heard a little bit from Andrew about what the Methodist Church in Epworth are doing legally to HSBC. We've heard a little bit about the imperative for us to act as Christians. So Rosie, can you tell us a little bit more about what practically we can do? We've heard a little bit about moving banks. We've heard about talking to our pension providers. Can you talk us through some steps that we can all go away and scribble down and do when we get home?
I'm going to do my very best. I've worked on banks campaigning for a number of years now with the Just Money movement alongside people of all faiths and none. And while we've seen some progress from some banks, as we've heard today, it's still a stark fact that banks like HSBC and Barclays and alongside other big global banks are continuing to put huge sums of money into fossil fuel expansion, into oil and gas and coal companies, and backtracking on their climate policies. So my sense is that the movement, and that includes all of us, that has grown up around holding banks and other financial institutions to account on climate is more necessary than it has ever been. Because some progress has been made, but there has been such a lot, as I said, of backtracking on commitments, and we can't let that happen. But it's also a movement that is stronger and more diverse than ever. And I find that really hopeful, both in terms of groups and organisations that are getting involved in banks campaigning and in the tactics they are using. And we've heard this brilliant example today of the legal tools that the Methodist Church is using. We've seen charities like Christian Aid and Action Aid moving banks for ethical reasons and talking about that. We've seen groups of universities working closely together to find greener banking and investment options. I know of local councils that are being urged by citizens to unlock more finance for green projects, and a growing number of churches reviewing where they bank and invest. So this is the movement that is growing and that is really necessary. And thank you for the part that you have played in that. And we've been coming to Greenbelt for many years, and the number of conversations that Just Money Movement has about greener finance, greener banking, they grow and grow every year. People's knowledge and attention to the issues is really deepening. And I know many of you are also then speaking to others in your churches about this. As Claire said earlier, all of us are linked in some way to the banking system, whether that's through our own current and saving accounts, through our organisations and institutions and where they bank, but also politically, through the financial rules and regulations that govern the banking financial sector that our MPs debate. But there is a danger that when we talk about banks and the financial system, that it also seems very abstract and distant from us. Maybe a difficult topic to get started in local churches. It then is very easy to ignore. or when it comes to campaigning, it can just feel like a very challenging thing to get other people excited and involved in. So I think it's really important that we've heard today from Andrew those stories of communities that are affected by banks like HSBC and what they choose to finance. And it's those voices and stories that I want to urge us to give priority to. And it's those communities that we act in solidarity with when we do something that seems kind of fairly boring and simple, like switching our bank account. We're standing in solidarity with communities like those affected by the Cerrejón mine. Last year, I went along to HSBC's AGM in London to ask a question about their fossil fuel financing. And I did it with the one share that we hold as an organisation to engage with the bank. So important that you know that you can do that. You can do that as an individual as well. And we weren't the only people there. There were other faith groups. There were other activists. And I just want to tell you very briefly the story. I heard a young woman speak up in front of me. Her name was Patience. She was a Ugandan climate activist. And she was there and she stood up amongst all the shareholders in their suits. And it's a real interesting place to be. You really feel the power and wealth in the room. She stood up very bravely and she challenged HSBC on their financing of projects connected with the East African crude oil pipeline, which some of you will know about and many of you will have campaigned on. HSBC is linked to that project, providing $1.78 billion dollars in finance to companies involved in that project. But it's what Patience said after the AGM, as we gathered as a kind of group of activists, shareholders and campaigners, it really stayed with me. She was talking about the way that banks' customers can take action too. And she said, you need to speak up, you need to hold your bank to account, and you need to help protect communities like mine from climate disaster. So that's a task for all of us, to act in solidarity with communities like Patience's. And what does that solidarity look like in practice? I just want to say very briefly how churches and individuals can act and to give you some takeaway actions. So for individuals, I urge you to get involved in the big bank switch and consider moving your current account to a greener bank to demonstrate the demand for a greener banking sector. The big bank switch is coordinated by Just Money Movement, Operation Noah, Laudato Si Movement and Just Love. And we've recently been joined by EcoChurch and Green Christian as networks that are also really keen to support and educate people around switching to greener banks. It's a fairly simple action that you can take as an individual, and there are resources on our website to help you look at your current bank and find a greener option. And I know from conversations I've had already today at Greenbelt, lots of you have made that switch already. But when I'm out speaking to groups and churches, I still find lots of people who haven't considered their choice of bank to be part of their climate action. So please do keep talking to others about greener banking and signpost them to the big bank switch. Churches can take practical action with their banking too. Sometimes that can feel a bit harder to get the conversation going. You can pick up a greener banking guide for churches on the Just Money stall, or you can come along and chat further if you want to explore how to get your church to switch. And we speak regularly to the smaller, greener, more ethical banks who know that there are occasionally barriers, practical barriers to switching for churches that need particular services or access to deposit cash. Those are the questions that your church treasurers will be asking. But there are often ways to overcome those barriers, and we're really keen to advocate on your behalf for what churches need from their banks. The banking sector should serve charities, churches. It should serve the whole community. So do come and talk to us if you're struggling to switch to a greener bank. We can work out how we can support you. We've been talking more about banks today. It's obviously part of a much bigger picture. Billions of pounds of private finance through pensions that have been mentioned already, investments that are propping up the fossil fuel industry that could instead be proactively funding the green transition and a more hopeful future. So if we're talking about how church actions and individual actions and political advocacy and legal tools can all work together for change, then we need to have that bigger vision too. What are our pensions invested in? There's £3 trillion in UK pensions alone. How could that be put to better use? And how could our own or our church's savings and investments support more investment in climate solutions? one thing that really encourages me and gives me hope, and I think it's being talked about on the programme at Greenbelt this year, is around clean energy, community-owned renewable energy in the UK and elsewhere. Banks, pension funds, and our own savings and investments could provide some of that financial power that gets those kinds of projects off the ground. So if you're interested in thinking about how your church locally or your denomination could ensure that more of its money is actively supporting climate solutions and care for creation, then I urge you to find out more about the Green Investment Declaration, which you can find via Operation Noah's website. There are churches and religious communities in the UK and globally who are already pioneering the way in investing in line with their commitment to climate justice. And I'm really excited why we've got Andrew and Hamish on the stage to say that the Methodist Church and Epworth are going to be the newest signatories signing up to the Green Investment Declaration. So thank you to all of you who've worked behind the scenes to make that happen. Really excited to have you signing up to that as a commitment. So the Green Investment Declaration is about taking that step towards investing more into climate solutions, and there's a wealth of resources to support you in having a conversation with your church or your denomination about the different levels of the declaration and what that might practically look like for you. There are so many ways in which we can drive change and get involved in shaping a greener economy. We can do that by educating ourselves and others. We can do that by taking part in collective action, like signing the open letter in support of the Methodist Initiative. We can do it by bank switching. We can do it by talking to our MPs. All of this helps shift the narrative about what finance is for, because I think that's what it comes down to. What is money and finance for? It should be serving people and planet, not the other way around. And again, coming back to what Claire said right at the beginning, that young person in the US who said, you know, don't undermine what we're doing. I think that's the point that I want to leave it on, is what we can't allow is for banks to continue to undermine the progress that is being made. So let's keep being part of that movement that is calling banks out and thinking about where our money can be used for most good.
Thank you so much, Rosie. I hope, I see a lot of you scribbling that down. I hope that you can go away and have those conversations in your churches and communities about practical steps you can do to engage with the financial institutions we're all part of and put pressure on them to change their ways. And when they don't, look at other pathways like legal action or moving away and voting with your feet. So thank you so much for that overview, Rosie. And as you say, I work with Operation Noah, which partners with Just Money Movement on a lot of these initiatives. And you can find lots more information about all of that on both of our websites. So, do keep looking at that. I think we're ready to go to a time of questions. There's been quite a lot of information thrown at you, and now time to hear from you if you have any questions.
Hi, thank you so much, everyone. I'm Michelle. I'm from Christian Climate Action. And something else people can do is to vigil outside cathedrals this autumn. We're having a weekend, 17th and 18th of October, when we're going to be calling our cathedrals to switch banks, to be beacons in this conversation to their communities and their congregations. And there's going to be more information on the Christian Climate Action website about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll hold it. Okay. Many of you here will be members of the National Trust. It has 5.5 million members, the National Trust Bank with Barclays Bank. Barclays, like HSBC, are a major financial supporter of the fossil fuel industry. Christian members, along with allies, have put a proposed resolution to the AGM, which is in November this year. And so those of you who are members are going to be receiving by email your voting papers in about 2 weeks from now. And the resolution calls on the National Trust, in effect, to dump Barclays. It's phrased rather more kindly than that, perhaps. But it asks for them to seek out a bank, to re-tender for banking services, which charities have to do from time to time, and to seek out a bank which has values and proven practice which best fits with the values of the National Trust. So,
thank you.
Hi,
see how far this lead goes. Thank you.
I'd like to be able to see them. I received two pensions, a church pension and a state pension. And I'm glad to say that the church pension, after much effort, has now divested from fossil fuels and other things. But I wonder, what is it possible to do, if anything, about trying to change and influence one's state pension? If I ever ask this of anybody, they always say nothing. But now I'm with the experts, I thought I might ask you.
That's a very good question. And one thing actually that might be quite helpful is, well, I said that Rosie and I work together, and one of the things that we do is run over the summer and autumn this year a green investment roadshow around the UK. The next one is on the 7th of September in London, then we're moving up to Worcester and Edinburgh. And as part of that, we're looking at how Christians can talk to local authority pensions. So that's not quite answering your question, but it's how we can use our voice to first get our own house in order, talk to our own churches about what they can do, but secondly, use Christian voices to speak to our local authorities within our regions, because they hold billions and billions, and very, very little is in climate solutions. We did some investigations into Bristol local authority for the roadshow we had there in June, and about 7% of their total pension pots are invested in anything to do with climate or the environment. So that's 93% that isn't. So there's a huge room for improvement there. So do come along and join that campaign if you're able to through the Green Investment Roadshows. But Rosie, you might want to say a little bit more about the state pension.
Working. Oh, it says. So I think it is, yeah, it's important to know about how your pension is funded, because some pensions like teachers' pensions and NHS pensions, they're funded out of like the current tax budget. So they're not like an invested fund, like a workplace pension. So it's, yeah, understanding what type of pension you have and whether and how it's being funded, because if it's just currently being funded out of the current government's tax budget, then it's not being invested in fossil fuel companies in the same way that a workplace pension that you're paying into is being held in funds. So that's, I guess, an important thing to understand a bit more about. It's also worth just being aware that the government is currently undertaking a big pensions review. This is like the biggest review it's done in many, many years. It's mostly looking at pension adequacy and inequality, but there's been a lot of campaigning being done by a broad section of campaigners and organisations saying you need to look at climate risk too. So this would affect things like the local authority pension funds, and saying if you're thinking about having a more secure future for people who are going to retire in 20, 30 years' time, and you're thinking about inequality, you absolutely have to be thinking about climate risk and the kind of future that our current pensions are funded. And there's been some really good progress being made by that. There's been some really good cross-parliamentary debate and conversation and support from politicians from lots of different parties trying to get that point made. So it's all a bit technical perhaps to get into right at the moment, but if that's something that interests you, I'm really happy to talk more with you about it and talk about the kind of points you could talk to your MP about to make sure that as the pensions review continues to go on, and I think it's due to finish next September, that you can start having those points made so that they are being brought up again and again to make sure that in that review, climate risk is absolutely heard for front and centre.
So it's a question for Andrew, really. I'm picking up on, sorry to pick up on one word in everything you said, but it's the word compensation, because I think in some ways that buys into the opponent's game, doesn't it? It's saying there is a financial cost that if you pay it, it's okay. And actually what they're doing is criminal. How much do you think we should pursue these compensation cases, and how much should we try and make a case that this is actually criminal activity and you need to be punished rather than the compensation for the victims?
Yeah, that's a really fair point and a really interesting one. If you look at who's in UK prisons right now, it's not a lot of bankers. So there is a, you know, a different type of burden of proof and another level of difficulty and a political layer that's involved in holding these people to account in a criminal court. And a local person, an indigenous person, might receive some sort of sense of justice as a result of that. But that also doesn't put food on their table and allow them to move locations into somewhere healthier and things like that. I think we do need a reform on what our ability to find companies is, the level at which we can find companies. And in this country, it's pretty restricted. The level of kind of levies you can apply on companies in a civil court is much restricted than it is somewhere like in the United States. And you are seeing companies now in places like the US start to feel the bite of those levels of compensation. Look at Meta, for example, and their $18 billion settlement they just agreed. So we have to get to a level where it starts to hit those bankers' bonuses, where they start having to make difficult decisions. And right now, the current framework of the law doesn't allow that. Absolutely, some people need to go to jail for this. They need to go to jail for many actions that they've committed. The amount of trust that's placed in banks by the public and the countless times they let the public down, both the British public and the public at large around the world, it is criminal. And we are being gaslit. We are being defrauded. If any of us in this room acted the way a bank does, we would be in jail. And so there does need to be reform to those laws. The FCA needs to be empowered. The PRA needs to be empowered to hold those people to account in criminal courts, for sure. People should be nervous becoming a banker, not looking at the pound signs.
Was there anyone else? Yes.
Going back to the pensions, and I think one of the issues, isn't it, is that the pension funds have to maximise their return. And I think that's the same for charities that have got money invested and stuff. They've got laws and regulations that they're having to follow that say that they need to maximise their returns. So are there funds and investments that, well, partly do the law need to change on those rules, which is perhaps what you were saying, Rosie, about the review, but are there funds and places that that can be invested in that do are able to give some kind of legal return that these organisations can use?
Oh, I can answer this one. This is a good marketing one for Epworth here. Yes, 100% of Epworth clients are churches and charities. All we do is invest on behalf of churches and charities. And we have about £1.5 billion of church and charity investment. And we do that to a level that we think is ethically acceptable in consultation with all those clients, right? There has to be trade-offs in everything. And trustees across pensions and charities do have a legal obligation to seek good returns. Now, charities have a bit more flexibility now. There was a legal case called Butler Sloss, and that opened up the avenue for charities to prioritize ethics over returns. This is a big change in regulation because of this court case. But what we're saying is, if you look over the last 25 years, ethical investing, so that's X oil and gas, X armaments, X tobacco, X gambling, all these sorts of things, the sin stocks, as we like to call them. And then also looking at positive investments like alternatives. Over the last 25 years, that has matched market returns. Okay, so there's a big lie being sold to us by a lot of the investment houses. It says you have to sacrifice something. You have to sacrifice returns to invest ethically. You don't. All you have to do is change your time horizons. And for charities, it's not just maximizing today's returns. It's looking at over the next decade, two decades, three decades. So ethical investing will give you a bumpier ride. You'll have increased volatility. but the road is still on the same trajectory as the market. On pensions, it's really difficult because trustees do have a legal obligation to maximize returns. The whole goal of a pension trustee, if any of you have ever been in a pension trustee, is to have future liabilities, the money you're going to have to pay out in the future, meet present assets. Okay? And you're legally obligated, you're legally obligated to meet that goal, or do the best effort you can to meet that goal. So this is where consultations with the government need to happen and are happening, where just like Butler Sloss, they can begin to take into account the long-term climate risk, the long-term social risk, and apply those metrics. What we think over the long term, why companies investing in sustainability, why companies concerned about their workforce, why companies concerned about the broader society in which they operate, they tend to do better because management that has the ability and space to think about those things is often much more effective management. Okay, so that means they're already running a company well, and therefore they have the headspace to think about all these things they may consider nice. So that's why long term, those returns aren't sacrificed.
Thank you. I think we might have time for one more. We've got 2 minutes. Is there another?
All the big pension companies have what they call ethical funds. Are they actual genuine funds, or are they, is it just greenwashing and they're just splitting up their existing sort of budget to sort of give them names?
Thank you.
So there was an FCA initiative called SDR. It was a labeling initiative to enable investors to look at a fund and determine how ethical it was, right? A bit like, you know, your traffic light system on a food product. A company called Aberdeen, they keep shortening their name. Now it's just Aberdeen. They've taken out all the vowels. I think they're adding them back now because no one knows how to pronounce it. They had 46 funds, okay, that converted to ethical funds within a span of about 48 hours. Now, that shows you how much greenwashing there is in the industry. Some of the pension providers have genuine ethics-based funds, but remember, they're still there to maximize returns, and they view climate risk and social risk very differently to how we in this tent might view climate and social risk. They're looking at in a numbers and sense point of view, not in a kind of moral ethic as we do. So I think we've got different definitions between the pension providers on what is ethical. But there are some out there. The problem is the vast majority of their money is going to their non-ethical or their standard funds. So you're still investing and contributing to that overall company that is providing a wide range of products. To give you one more fact about greenwashing, this whole ESG movement that happened across the world, within the City of London, all these departments started popping up, ESG departments, SRI departments, and you saw all this great marketing. When you drill down into the numbers, On the whole, 70% of ESG expenditure by these investment companies was going to marketing. Only 30% was going into ESG research and company engagement. So think of that what you will about greenwashing.
Thank you. Well, I think it's it just shows what a minefield it is to think about our finances, but also how crucial it is to be engaging with this and to be active consumers and putting our faith where our money is, and linking the two rather than ne'er the twain shall meet. And I think this given a lot of food for thought today. So thank you very much to our panel. And do continue to engage with these questions. Do take a look at the Just Money Movement and Operation NOAA websites for more information on bank switching, pensions, investments, and keep it an active conversation so that both as Christians and as churches, we can move with our feet and hold our financial institutions to account for funding the climate crisis. So thank you very much to our panel today.
Thank you so much. I was just going to add my thank you to you, to Claire and Andrew and Hamish and Rosie, and just the amount of things that I've personally learned from being here about how many statistics and facts and brainwashing and gaslighting that I've bought into and didn't know. This has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much, Greenbelt and Hothouse. Can we give them one last round of applause?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.